This podcast is free and it's accessible to everyone thanks to support from listeners like you. If you value this show, please consider supporting its production by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute to give, and you'll be helping to support the production of this podcast. Make a donation at kuow.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks.
You're listening to Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. Last month, joblessness in our state reached its highest levels since the COVID pandemic, higher than the national average. And the first thing many people do when they've lost a job is file for unemployment benefits. But Washington's unemployment system itself is still reeling from the 1-2 punch of COVID. That's when applications spiked, a massive fraud scheme took $1 billion from the system, and hundreds of millions of dollars were overpaid, partially through confusion on the part of people claiming benefits. People like Gary Moon.
I had no experience navigating unemployment before.
Gary applied for unemployment on behalf of his son, Kenny. Kenny is a high-functioning person with autism. During the beginning of the pandemic, he was briefly let go from his part-time job. And this is where the confusion begins, so bear with me. Kenny was only working about 10 hours a week, which meant he didn't qualify for regular unemployment. But he was eligible for a special federal pandemic assistance program that was designed to help part-time employees, like contract and gig workers.
It was very confusing, and it's kind of funny because we had to start off by applying for the regular unemployment. And I said, wait a minute, no, we don't have enough hours in order to get that. And they said, well, you have to apply for this and be rejected, and then you can apply for the regular pandemic unemployment. Not quite what you would have thought.
Kenny went back to work at the same job a few months after being laid off. At that point, Gary wasn't sure if he should continue filing for the extra COVID-era benefit. But based on advice he was able to find online, he kept filing. Father and son made sure to report Kenny's new income, and along the way, Gary checked the boxes he thought he was supposed to. All the while, sure, he was a little uneasy. It was hard to get answers from the state's Employment Security Department.
It wasn't unusual at that time that you're on the phone for 3 hours, you know, waiting on hold.
So you couldn't really get a, you know, that if I call one person, they'd say, yeah, go ahead and just continue filing your claims, you know. You know, as long as you're reporting your income and your hours, everything is will be fine.
Then, after a year of getting payments, Gary received a notice from the state. It said that for the last year, Kenny should not have collected unemployment. According to the Employment Security Department, the claims should have been denied. From the state's perspective, Gary had misrepresented his son's financial situation, and the state wanted those overpaid funds back with interest. The total was roughly $30,000. And Gary says it's all because he filled out paperwork the way he thought he was supposed to.
I believe that, you know, when you say it was misrepresented, it requires bad intent, or you provided false answers to questions or something like that. In this situation, I never answered questions like these before.
Since that initial notice, Gary has felt whiplash trying to navigate the ins and outs of the state's unemployment system. His appeal of the overpayment decision was denied, but after some review, the Employment Security Department found that it had erred in its initial calculation and knocked down his balance by about $10,000. So today, Gary's on the hook for $19,000 in overpayment. For now, he's on a payment plan while he waits to see if he qualifies for an overpayment waiver. The state revised its policy last year to make more than 100,000 people eligible for overpayment forgiveness if they can prove equity and good conscience reasons, such as not understanding English instructions or being unable to get through to ESD with questions. But like many other people, that wait for Gary has taken close to a year. According to attorney Ann Paxton, the issues that Gary Moon encountered with the unemployment system are all too common. And the ongoing problems also make it harder for people who legitimately need unemployment benefits in our state to access funds. Paxton works with the Unemployment Law Project, which recently published a study that details problems in Washington's system and recommends reforms. And Ann Paxton joins me now. Hi, Ann. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for inviting me.
So in 2023, you report in this new survey, this new study, that Washington turned down more than 48% of unemployment applications that it received. You note that this is 2 and 3 times the typical denial rate of other high-income states like New York and California. What accounts for this high denial rate in Washington state for unemployment claims?
You know, that's a very good question. We're actually seeking a full answer to that question and have a meeting coming up very soon with the Employment Security Department. But we noted that when we were doing research for this report that we just finished, we noted that Washington's denial rate in 2023 was 48%. We thought that was really high. We looked at other high-income states. You know, a lot of states have much lower, like California, 18%. Oregon was 27%.
The denial rates.
Denial rates. So where did this come from? We really don't know, but we know that it took quite a while for Washington to get to this level of high denials. So something serious is going on. And there are a lot of factors that have contributed to that that we tried to discuss in the report based on the interviews we did with claimants.
Yeah, you surveyed 100 people about things that they're struggling with when it comes to the Employment Security Department. What did you find? What did they tell you was the most difficult part of applying and trying to get access to unemployment benefits?
Number one, almost all the applicants, not just the group we interviewed, which were people who mostly had encountered difficulties, and now it turns out that's not that rare, but almost all the applicants have to navigate the system through e-services portal. So that's not something that's accessible and easily navigable by a lot of people. There's almost never any two-way communication between the claimant, the person applying, and the Employment Security Department. Employment Security Department sends messages, but basically the secret message that they're projecting is do not reply because we won't answer you. And that's what happens. So the claimants are left in a quandary because a lot of times, multiple times they told us about being unable to answer a question because they didn't see how it pertained to their particular situation. That was just almost, it was repeated over and over. They could not get through on the phone. They had to talk with a person and they never did get a chance to do it. So we think that increases the error rates. It makes sure that there's probably more denials than there should be. And it just makes applying for benefits a very difficult process.
And when somebody is denied, what is their recourse? If they say, this is an inaccurate denial, I am owed these benefits and I should receive them, what can they do?
Well, one thing they can do to start with, and this relates to what the Unemployment Law Project does, we offer civil legal aid to people who have been denied benefits. So the main thing that our attorneys do is act as representatives for claimants who've been denied before an appeal is filed with the Employment Security Department, which sends it to the Office of Administrative Hearings, to be heard before a judge. And that's what we help claimants with who tend to have, they tend to be low-income claimants, and we can't manage more than a fraction of the ones who need help.
Yeah, and it's a big step. I mean, to contact your organization, to get representation, like these are difficult things to do and kind of out of the ordinary for the average person who's struggling to get by, especially if they've, you know, been laid off. We've heard that some applications for unemployment benefits can wait months and months to hear back about a decision. Is there also just an issue with delay overall? And when you need to pay rent or when you need to buy groceries, waiting around isn't really tenable.
Absolutely not. And this is what we heard over and over. The level of stress that instills in people is indescribable because we're not talking about, you know, waiting in a queue at the supermarket. We're talking about people who are looking at not being able to pay for groceries next month or being evicted from their apartment. That happened to several of the people we spoke with. And there really isn't a requirement there be rapid response. The Employment Security Department was overwhelmed during the pandemic and everyone understood that it was going to take extra time. But it still takes extra time. And before the pandemic, it took extra time. And there isn't a real accountability on the part of the Employment Security Department for those delays. I know they struggle to keep enough staff and they do as conscientious a job as they can under their circumstances, but they don't really have an official obligation to respond in a certain period of time. And it's unfortunate.
A lot of people will remember this massive fraud that was going on during the pandemic. The Employment Security Department in Washington ended up losing out on $1 billion in mistakenly paid benefits. Hundreds of millions, you know, was going to cyber criminals, thieves. Investigators have recovered about 2/3 of that money, but the Attorney General's office has said that hundreds of millions of dollars will likely never be recovered. Is there any indication that some of the problems people are experiencing is related to the fallout from fraud, as the agency is probably looking closer and scrutinizing applications a little bit tighter?
Absolutely. And a fraud, of course, is always a serious concern. But what the pandemic did was put everything on steroids. Let's put it that way. So the number of benefit applicants skyrocketed. The federal programs which were added were for many a lifesaver. They added the $600 a week extra payment, but they created a whole new complex of requirements to navigate and to not understand on the part of the claimants. And then this massive organized, mostly international fraud that was spawned by the generous federal programs led to losses of hundreds of millions of dollars, as you say. And that was followed by this reactive clampdown on benefit applications because every applicant came under suspicion. But the claimants we talked to were not in that category. They weren't sophisticated enough, A, and B, they didn't really have the motivation to commit fraud. They had genuine applications. So the next economic crisis, we'll probably see something very similar.
Another huge problem that came up during the pandemic is this overpayment phenomenon. Basically, people are now being asked to repay unemployment benefits that they improperly received. You know, sometimes these rules were things that they didn't understand. It's not intentional fraud, but they didn't realize they weren't supposed to be getting the money in some cases. What's happening now with overpayment? I mean, I understand that there's a waiver process that people can apply to. Are some people still on the hook for this? And what are people facing?
It's very complicated situation. Overpayments in general rarely happen because of fraud on the part of claimants or even fault. Usually there's a combination of fault between the agency and the claimants. But in even more cases, it's because the claimant couldn't get assistance with their application. And they may have made a mistake that was fatal for their application that was discovered later. And they said, oh, you have to pay this all back. One real problem is that the Employment Security Department relies, to its detriment, it relies too much on the IT system to handle all of the process of the applications. And there's not enough human assistance along the way to prevent this kind of thing from happening. I think that would really cut down on the number of overpayments.
Yeah, there's this waiver program is now available to people. Are most people now able to get a waiver? I mean, is the overpayment issue still a big problem for folks?
So overpayment waiver is always a possibility, but it's been restrained by certain requirements. The first recourse you have if you have an overpayment imposed is to file an appeal of the reason for the overpayment. So that's generally what people do. If they're turned down then they can apply for a waiver, which can be granted under grounds of equity and good conscience. So how do you define that? Traditionally, the department has only defined that in terms of financial hardship. But because there were so many overpayments resulting from the massive confusion created by these new federal programs, and just generally the besiegement of the entire Employment Security Department by these applications, in their own good conscience, they decided to offer a big program of waivers on an individual basis, which was extremely broad and actually unprecedented among the states. It included not just financial hardship as a criterion for waiver, but also inability to speak perfect English. Limited English proficiency was one reason. Another was a disability. Another was you couldn't get through on the phone. Another was you didn't understand that you couldn't spend the money because it might not be actually owed to you. You relied on having the money. So that was a reason that you shouldn't be asked to return it. Those are all standard in contract law, but have never been really standard in unemployment law. So this is really unprecedented. And the Employment Security Department had at least 150,000 of these waiver applications to handle. And it has, in addition to offering the waivers, they've been plowing through all the applications, they've also extended a relief of the interest charges because the process of processing these waivers is taking so much time. So it won't be until 2025, I think, until they finish with these waiver applications. But many people have gotten waivers. At last count, my understanding was that at an average overpayment rate of $1,000 per applicant, they had waived $47 million in overpayments. I haven't heard anything comparable in other states. It does show that the Employment Security Department is really trying to deal with a very difficult situation.
Yeah. And that relief for the interest was a bill that passed in this last session, I understand, that put off the interest owed by people that got overpayments until 2025. So there have been some tweaks to try to bring some relief in that way. We talked with Gary Moon, who experienced an overpayment. he had filed for unemployment on behalf of his autistic son when his son lost a job. And then eventually his son got another job, but he was sort of online and reading some stuff that said, just keep filing for unemployment claims. And that wasn't the right thing to do, but the state didn't tell him to stop. And then they were, you know, later told they needed to repay $30,000 in overpayments. Is that a common story, what Gary and his son Kenneth experienced? I mean, is that similar to what other people are experiencing?
You know, when people have disabilities, they have a whole unique set of problems that a lot of people don't experience. So I haven't heard of anything that extensive happening for that particular reason. But these misunderstandings are the reasons for overpayments in many cases. And this was very understandable that Kenny was continuing to apply. Everyone was very confused about what was being offered. Gig workers could qualify, people who are self-employed could qualify. It was not clear at all. So in the contract law, that would be called detrimental reliance. They spent the money in good faith because they received it thinking that they were eligible for it. It was not fraudulent in any way. They shouldn't be held to account for repaying it.
Your study includes recommendations for how things could improve here, what the state could do to fix some of these issues with unemployment applications, especially this incredibly high denial rate for unemployment benefits. What kinds of reforms would you like to see to improve things?
So we talked to so many people. We do have a number of small recommendations that we think would provide specific improvements to the system. But I think our most important goal is to reverse the decade-long decline in workers' ability to receive unemployment compensation in the state. So that is a big mission. The system as currently structured is hurting people in both broad and specific ways. And that's one reason why we're calling for a commitment to tracking of data that will show the real impact. For example, broken down by race, by gender, by disability, limited English proficiency, who is being most hurt here? And we know the people with barriers are the ones when there's a decline in recipiency rate, a number of denials, they're the ones who are getting hurt, but we don't have the evidence. So we would like to see that hard data show that. And we think that once people see what a scandalous situation it is, it will help improve the chances for real reform on the ground. And the other thing is to make that data transparent, let the public know so that they will see, and employers will see, this is hurting people, and it's hurting people in very unfair ways. The other most urgently needed reform is two-way communication, and that was what we found was so missing in the whole process. ESD would send out notices, the claimants would send in their application pieces, and they just never meshed because there isn't communication going on. And we think it has to be some kind of direct communication, either by phone or in person, with an assistant who will be able to look at the gestalt of the whole claim and not just individual pieces of it that an IT system can handle perfectly well. But a human is really needed for a lot of this kind of work. And we also urge increased exposure of employers' role in curbing benefits. That's something we discovered along the way as well. There are a lot of ways that employers can slow down, interfere with, overburden the whole process, and prevent employees from getting benefits. And we feel there should be more accountability for employers for that impact.
What kinds of things are the employers doing?
Well, we reported in many examples in our survey answers. For example, there's a requirement in state law that employers inform employees when there's a job separation about the availability of benefits. And in our survey, majority of claimants we talked to said they either knew little or nothing. Most of them did not hear it from their employers. Another way is by blocking benefits by filing an appeal. And they may have a sincere reason that they disagree the person should get benefits, but they have a lot of latitude to slow down many other people's claims as well. And they're never held to account for even a malicious, but never mind, badly founded appeal. And many times there are no-show at the hearing, which causes, as you mentioned, a lot of distress on the part of claimants, and in many cases causes them to just drop out of the whole process and give up anyway, because they're very intimidated about the idea of appearing before a judge. So those are just a couple of examples. But also the employers in general have pressed for legislation over the years, such as our very restrictive good cause quit law, which will curb benefits. And there have been a couple of studies showing that that's what's happened in the wake of these bills, among others. There's not a real friendly environment in the employer community towards benefits for clear reasons. I mean, no one likes to pay increased taxes, but it's hurting people in very specific and very hurtful ways.
Yeah. Ann Paxton is an attorney and policy director for the Unemployment Law Project. They published a new study this month called Voices of Washington's Unemployed about the barriers that people are experiencing applying for unemployment benefits in this state. Ann, thank you very much for being here and for explaining what you found.
So nice to meet you, Libby. And thanks so much for being interested in this.
And we did reach out to the Employment Security Department for a response to the Unemployment Law Project's report. In a statement, the director of the Unemployment Insurance Customer Service for the state, J.R. Richards, said, quote, "We recognize and agree that continued improvements in customer service delivery are needed. Our focus is on equitable access to accessible services that meet our customers in the ways and places they want to interact with us. That means we are working to uncover areas where we are falling short and improve it," end quote. And in an email, the department said that it has completed 62% of the 72,000 submitted overpayment waiver applications so far. For now, Gary Moon is still waiting to hear whether he will qualify. Thanks for listening to Soundside. This show is only possible because listeners support us. If you're able to give right now, please check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org.
Seattle in the 90s. A tidal wave of iconic music roars out of this sleepy city and launches a pop culture revolution. Here's a story you haven't heard. Let the Kids Dance is a new podcast about the rise and fall of Seattle's Teen Dance Ordinance, the law that made it illegal for young people to go to concerts. A story of moral panic, grassroots activism, and an unstoppable music community that fought for its freedom. Listen to Let the Kids Dance from KUOW and the NPR Network.